This is CBS Eye on the World. Here's John Batchelor.
To Seoul, South Korea, with the President of the United States in these last days, Mary Kissel, the Executive Vice President of Stevens Incorporated, former senior advisor to the Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, traveled these same air routes many times in her service for the State Department in the United States. So she is the excellent person to speak to because the president, President Biden, meets with the new president of South Korea, President Yoon, and a sharp declaration from the new president, no more appeasement towards North Korea. Mary, a very good evening to you. I welcome President Yoon. Congratulations to the people of South Korea. You struggled through President Moon, the previous president, and his concessions to North Korea. Is this a new day on the Korean Peninsula? Good evening to you, Mary.
Good evening to you, John. Well, before I answer that question, I just want to say it's terrific to see President Biden out in the region visiting some of our closest allies in Asia Pacific. It does make a difference when we physically show up in person. So kudos to him for getting over there. I wish he had gotten there sooner, but I'll take it now. As regards North Korea policy, I think that it's important to have both carrot and stick. Because we've tried one or the other in the past, and neither has worked. We tried appeasement under the Clinton administration. Remember Madeleine Albright dancing with Kim Jong-il, and the North Koreans quickly, took the cash that we gave them in aid and continued to build their nuclear program. So they kind of broke that agreement as soon as it was inked. And then we tried just ignoring them under the Obama administration. That didn't work very well. We took a tougher stance under Bush. That didn't work. The only interesting development really was under President Trump, where you had really strong U.S. deterrence, where he said, look, we're going to rain down fire and fury on you if you even think about developing this nuclear program. But at the same time, we will provide a brighter future for you in North Korea if you decide to engage with us. So President Biden on his trip did a little of that. He was asked if he had a message for Kim Jong-un, and he said, hello, period. Sort of a sly, humorous way of saying, maybe we might be open to talks under the right conditions. But he also bolstered the stick part of it with President Yoon, where he signaled that they would, the United States and South Korea would consider, joint military exercises, expanding those. So I think it was a good visit. It was a positive visit. And again, just really important to see the president physically out there standing with our allies in Asia Pacific.
Tokyo was next in these last days, and the president's announcement of the economic framework for the Indo-Pacific. Indo-Pacific is the new way to talk about this vast landscape stretching from Africa all the way to the shores of the United States, North America, and South America, the Indo-Pacific. But this looks like the old TPP. To remind myself, the TPP was much in discussion in the campaign season of 2016. I believe for Democratic and Republican reasons, it was set aside or elbowed aside. The economic framework announced also looks, Mary, like the building of a coalition to resist the aggression of China. I puzzled about the Quad meeting, which is taking place now in Tokyo, being the same, but I was told not quite. It was more of an economic conversation between India, Australia, Japan, and the United States. This new economic framework, can we read this as something like NATO in the Pacific, Mary?
No, it's not a formal alliance. It's basically an agreement to start talking about important types of trade ties between our allies and partners in Asia Pacific. That's a good thing. I think it also exposes an uncomfortable reality, both for free traders on the right and for multilateralists on the political left, that many of these multilateral arrangements, especially on the trade front, are simply unworkable. The WTO functions on consensus. So when you have one of its biggest members, namely China, breaking very clear rules and you can't expel them, well, what are you supposed to do? How are you supposed to move forward? So I think there is an implicit recognition here that if we want to increase trade ties between friendly nations, we need a more flexible framework with perhaps smaller groupings of nations. So I think this is positive. Would I have liked to have seen more detail on it? Absolutely, yes. Would I have liked to have seen Taiwan included in some way? Yes, absolutely. But we shouldn't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. I think it's a good step. It actually builds on what the Trump administration laid out in its Indo-Pacific strategy. It's similar to it. Although, of course, under a U.S. Democrat administration, you'll see, you know, different priorities like climate change emphasized. But on the whole, I think you see some continuity here between the political right and left in the United States, a recognition that we need to think more creatively about how to both move our production and manufacturing away from China and how to strengthen our supply chains with allies and partners around the region and how to create and strengthen many of those bonds.
In a press conference in Tokyo, the president was asked, will he defend Taiwan militarily from the supposed aggression someday of the People's Republic of China? The Wall Street Journal editorial has this to say about these remarks. The press is saying President Biden blundered Monday in committing the U.S. to defend Taiwan. But after three similar statements in the last year, maybe he means it. The arguably much bigger mistake is his decision, the president's decision, not to include Taiwan in the new Indo-Pacific economic framework that the administration launched. Mary, is that a mistake, leaving Taiwan out? Have we told China that we don't entirely protect Taiwan? Given, I mean, Mary, for heaven's sakes, without Taiwan, there are no high-end chips in the world.
Well, I mean, there's a more foundational question, which is, are we eventually now or later going to recognize Taiwan as a nation or not? And you know, there is a scenario here where we could recognize both China and Taiwan under our understanding of the One China policy. It gives us that leeway in the language that was agreed way back when, several decades ago. But, you know, when I heard Biden's comments initially, I didn't like them. I sort of thought, oh, no, it's another gaffe. But, you know, the more I kind of thought through it, I thought, well, golly, if I don't understand it, maybe communist China doesn't understand it either. And this is actually pretty good a strategic ambiguity. And they don't know if we would intervene or not. And that would be a good thing. It would actually help U.S. deterrence. So I think my opinion of it changed. I think, you know, what would make me feel a little better is if President Biden's comments were accompanied by a real upsurge in military sales to Taiwan and more focused efforts to move semiconductor production into the Western Hemisphere, to rally allies also to do military exercises with us that very blatantly show China that we have interoperability and real power in the region. And look, I mean, the Chinese are very sending very clear signals. They did overflights with Russia while Biden was in North Asia with nuclear capable bombers. Wang Yi, the Chinese foreign minister, from May 26th to June 4th, is going to 8 countries in the South Pacific, including the Solomon Islands and Samoa, Fiji, Papua New Guinea, East Timor. They're making their intentions very, very clear. And I think that, you know, Biden's comments are good to start to be stronger on the issue. But there's just much more that we need to do if we want to deter what I'm increasingly worried is a Chinese invasion of Taiwan that is drawing ever closer.
The London Times in these last hours features a story of horror. We know the horror, but still to read it again. Chinese police told to shoot Uyghurs who try to escape camps. Cache of leaked files shows images of 3,000 believed to be held. The story continues. This is the London Times in these hours as the United Nations representative for human rights, Michelle Bachelet, a former president in Chile, I believe, is due in for a visit, the first visit by the UN human rights representative since 2005. Uyghur prisoners in the Western Chinese region of Xinjiang, writes the London Times, are to be shot on sight should they try to escape from re-education camps where they are said to be arbitrarily detained. A cache of police files allegedly obtained by hackers shared with foreign media reveals the faces of 3,000 people, including children, and three of them are pictured in the London Times story. Mary, you dealt with the Uyghurs, you dealt with Tibet, you've dealt with the predation of the Chinese regime for some time. I'll take the soft route. Is the UN ready to speak out? Is Michelle Bachelet in a position to say this is unacceptable? Would that be a start, Mary, to where we have to go?
You know, Michelle, well, first thing to say is that to your listeners is that the horrors that are being perpetrated against the Muslim majority Uyghurs, but other ethnic Muslims like Kazakhs and the Hui are beyond your worst imaginations. Forced sterilizations, forced abortions, Han men being moved into Uyghur women's homes and raping them, torture of all manner, children being taken away from their parents. This is just so horrific. And it's something that any feeling human being should denounce, and we should try to get China to change the behavior. We're using any tools that we can. And Muslim majority countries have a special responsibility to speak up, and they're not. Now, Michelle Bachelet's visit reminds me very much of the first big tour that former President Obama took to China. He was, I think, very well-meaning, as I assume Ms. Bachelet is as well, trying to engage in the dialogue. And the Chinese reneged on all of the promises that they made to televise President Obama's address to students. And he had no real unsupervised access. And hey, sure enough, Michelle Bachelet will also operate in what's called a closed loop, where the Chinese Communist Party will determine what she sees and the people to whom she speaks. So in many respects, this will be used as a propaganda tool by the party. She will not learn anything new, and it will benefit only Beijing. So I don't see the point of a highly managed visit like this. If China really had nothing to hide, then they would let her go wherever she wants to go, whenever she wants to be there. She'd have unsupervised surprise visits. They will never allow it, because we now know, thanks to firsthand testimony, satellite photos, leaked papers coming out of the Chinese Communist Party itself, and other means, we know exactly what's going on in Xinjiang. So until you see some change in regime, we will never get a true look from an outsider into those camps. So I'm sorry that she's going. Again, she may be very well-meaning, but this is only going to benefit the torturers and not those who are being tortured.
According to the BBC, the official files outline an internal police protocol that, quote, describes the routine of use of armed officers in all areas of the camp, the positioning of machine guns and sniper rifles in the watchtowers, and the existence of a shoot-to-kill policy for those trying to escape. That's the Uyghurs. There are less than 13 million Uyghurs in the solar system. And the People's Republic of China's Chinese Communist Party is persecuting them in a fashion that is consistent with what was declared in the last day of the Trump administration and has been continued throughout the Biden administration. This is genocide. This is crimes against humanity. Mary Kissel, Executive Vice President, Stevens Incorporated, former senior advisor to the Secretary of State. I'm John Batchelor. We're headed to Europe. This is CBS Eye on the World.